Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor Alison Littlejohn in this episode. Alison is Professor of Learning Technology with the Open University UK, and as you'll hear, she's been involved with some fascinating research and industry projects involving online learning. Alison and I talked in the Jenny Lee Building at the Open University's Milton Keynes campus. It's my privilege to be talking with Professor Alison Littlejohn, who is Professor of E-Learning at the Open University UK, but I understand, Alison, you're moving on soon. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you for asking me.
Alison, can we start with just a brief history of your career and publications?
My original career was as a scientist. I was a research scientist, and I guess that trained me to really think about evidence, how we change things through evidence base. One of the most fantastic steps in my career was when I started teaching chemistry. I did some teaching at Strathclyde University in Glasgow and at Glasgow University, and I really enjoyed being with the students. I was fascinated by the teaching. When I started teaching, I realised I didn't know any educational theories. So I went to see my friends at Glasgow University in the Teaching and Learning Centre and just read up as much as I could and started experimenting. And then I decided to move to the Thurso College, which was part of University of Highlands and Islands when it was setting up in the north of Scotland. The idea there was to take 15 colleges spread around the Highlands of Scotland and on some of the islands to bring together students to undertake degree courses. Each college might only have 5 or 6 students, so a degree course wasn't viable. But if you added that number across all the colleges and you used technology to connect them through distance learning, then it was a much more feasible option. And I realised, living in the north of Scotland, that education opportunities were not really available unless you moved somewhere else. So distance learning really could transform the lives of the people who wanted to study. And at that time, many of my students had been in the fishing industry. They were fishermen. The industry had collapsed. They had lost their jobs. Crofting wasn't doing very well either. And people needed to retrain and reskill. So I started experimenting with technologies. We got some European funding. I worked with 2 Erasmus exchange students. I authored 2 of my courses that I was teaching on CD-ROM at the time, because internet wasn't widely available. This was around 1992-93. And these courses were the first courses accredited by the Scottish Funding Council, which at the time was called ScotVec. So I realised that not only did technology allow people to learn at a distance, of course you could learn through correspondence courses, there were other ways of learning at a distance, but through the technology we could really think about pedagogy and how people could learn very difficult concepts. In chemistry, for example, it's difficult to learn how to relate what you do in a laboratory with the way that chemistry experiments are written, and also the way that molecules are represented. But by using technologies, you could allow visualizations and simulations that would enable students to really think about all these concepts. So that was the foundation of my work. After that, I won a Churchill scholarship to go to the States and to work with colleagues in various universities. So I went to MIT, Harvard, Berkeley, UCLA, UCSD, and the University of Colorado, where I worked with Loretta Jones, who was a professor in chemistry education, and she really was my mentor. And I owe much of what happened in my career after that to Loretta.
Was there a tipping point where you were in chemistry and then suddenly you were involved in e-learning? What happened there? What was that time?
It was a gradual transition. As I say, I went from being a chemistry researcher to experimenting with teaching. I went over and worked with Loretta Jones for a year. That was working in chemistry education. Then I came back to the UK and I got a job at University of Strathclyde as a lecturer in e-learning. And that's really when my career went from science to technology-enhanced learning. There I was working with academics across all disciplines in every part of the university. By then I realised that to have that evidence, to really understand is something working, you really need to know the theories and methodologies of education and to integrate that with the practice of each discipline.
So, Alison, you've researched a lot over the years. I think we talked about 7 books earlier.
Yes.
One of which made a really early impact on me, the Reusing Open Resources, which you've got there in front of you now. That was the first book I read which actually exposed me to your work. I was very impressed by it. I cited it many times. But can you give us some of the ideas and themes that your work has provided, which are still very pertinent for us today?
Yeah, that book was very interesting to work on because actually there were a whole range of questions that I had in my mind and that colleagues had that we used to talk about. By then, online learning was clearly becoming a promising way forward. One of the things that we realised was that people tended to create resources rather than necessarily use and share them. And it could be very expensive to really scale up learning online. So we were asking questions around, are there ways that people can share and reuse resources? And a lot of questions around that were, you know, could there be an economy of scale? How would people find resources that other people had created? How could that be contextualized within courses? So we worked with experts around the world. That was an edited volume. And we just looked at the latest research in each of those areas. Afterwards, we had a special edition, which is in the JIME journal, and we asked people to commentate and to critique. So it really started a debate around the subject. And yeah, of course, open educational resources is a key area at the moment and has been in technology-enhanced learning. But when we were working on the book, we actually did a follow-up 10 years later, which is Reusing Open Resources. And we looked back on the past 10 years. And this idea of an economy of scale hasn't really materialised as people imagined it would. And so we were asking some of the questions around, so why hasn't this revolution happened? And you know, what might we expect going forward in the future? And one of the reasons that has prevented this vision of an economy of scale of open educational resources is open education practice. Because what we have observed at, you know, various different times when we see how people are using technologies for teaching, there's a tendency to use current practice and to transfer that to the web. So, for example, people might take print materials and put them online and expect students to watch videos or read. When the reality, if I go back to when I first started using technologies, for me, the most transformative aspect of the technology is to enable students to learn key concepts in completely new ways. So don't just watch a video. Look at a visualization of something that you can't actually see, or try a simulation of an experiment. Or one of the early courses I created was in aerospace engineering. So I was working with a subject matter expert at Glasgow University. We put a course online in fluid dynamics. Students could actually operate an aircraft wing in a wind tunnel and gather data. And then the data set itself could be a reusable data set. So I imagine these open educational resources is much broader than text or images or books, but resources that people could gather, could share, could build new knowledge, and could learn during that process.
I remember too in your early book you talked about the granularity of the objects themselves and how difficult it was to decide even what the shape of a learning object should be. Which of course also impacted its reusability because it's designed to fit in a particular context and that context of course doesn't easily transfer elsewhere. I was really struck by how truly relevant those observations were and that they still seem quite relevant today.
Absolutely, and I think that's to do with how we think about online learning and teaching. Because if you think about online teaching being a course, then you will imagine the way that we've always structured courses. So a course is a beginning point and an end point. It has content in between. And sometimes we can overlook the activities that students actually undertake in order to learn. So that impacts on the granularity. Then the course becomes quite large in a sense that you have lots of content, and that content has to be contextualised not only to the discipline. So for example, if you take thermodynamics and you take something around gas laws or Boyle's law or something, it has to be contextualized depending on whether you're learning thermodynamics as an engineer or as a physicist or as a chemist, but also what level you're at and why you're learning it. Are you learning Boyle's law because you're an engineer actually trying to do something at work, or is it because you're studying for a diploma or a degree? So this contextualization becomes difficult. However, if you reuse something like a data set, then you can use that data with the different tools for manipulating the data or interpreting the data. There's a lot more flexibility around it. So for example, if companies make some of their data available about, you know, their operational data, maybe scaled down version, that could be used by economics students to really study the economics of different geographic areas. It could be used by business students to understand how different businesses operate and what it is that really drives their business model. Or it could be used by people who are setting up their own business to really understand how successful businesses operate. So there are many different ways. If we don't think of online learning as being a huge course, but we think about it differently as learning different concepts for a particular purpose or developing skills and knowledge actively, then we would think about these open educational resources in a different way.
It's interesting, you're talking through that, the tight link between effective online learning or digital learning practice and learning activity design. I mean, you've talked a lot about conceptual learning. It's the sort of educational background which I think adds a lot of value to your work. You don't think in terms of what technology can do, you think in terms of concepts, what students need to learn, the best way of actually getting them to learn. And the technology is almost incidental or facilitative of that.
That's right. There have been times when I've been talking with people about my work and I almost never mention the technology. But actually, it's the technology that's the enabler. You know, if we didn't have the internet, then we wouldn't be able to share, use and recreate resources of all different types in the way that we can. So it's not that the technology isn't important. And of course, behind that technology, there are lots of different ontologies and metadata and so on, which is absolutely critical to making it work. But my focus has really been on the learning, because my background is from working with students, from teaching and from seeing people's lives transforming through learning, and from my own life transforming through learning as well.
Alison, it's now coming to the end of 2018. We're about to enter another bold new year. Yeah. And you'll also be starting a different role at another institution, I understand.
Yes. So I'll be going to University of Glasgow.
So what are your observations about online learning at the current time? What are some of the key themes you see out there?
At the moment, I think we're in some ways beyond the era of MOOCs. Researchers are not talking about MOOCs quite as much, or there's more critique about it. Universities are not investing quite so much, and yet there's still some relevance of MOOCs, I think. So people still want to create them and produce them. But I think the context in which they're being produced is changing. For example, in the early days of MOOCs, first of all, they were set up by our colleagues in Canada, George Seaman, Stephen Downs, Dave Cornier. And it was very much grassroots, based on this idea of people connecting together in order to learn, pretty much around the principles that I mentioned earlier. And then it moved into an era where the more prestigious universities set up platforms. They were extending their global reach by creating courses on these platforms. But of course, the courses were conceptualized in quite a traditional way. So some of the early edX courses replicated in some ways what the campus experience might be. Mm. And that was a very different way of thinking about MOOCs. But since then, the whole idea of open and online has changed, and now MOOC has become synonymous with almost any kind of online learning. And I think some of the most promising areas are in developing countries, so enabling people in countries where there are fewer opportunities for education and resources to learn. But I published a book this year with my colleague Nina Hood from University of Auckland, and it was around this idea of MOOCs. We were asked to write a book about MOOCs. And when we thought about it, one of the key messages we wanted to put forward was that we have to really question what universities are doing through MOOCs. And so the book's called Reconceptualising Learning in a Digital Age, The Undemocratising Potential of MOOCs. So we're questioning this idea of, do MOOCs provide democratisation? So these claims that anyone can learn at any university, is that really true? Or is it a way for universities to have this global reach and to extend their power and extend their norms and values? And we're not saying it's one or the other. We're saying it's somewhere in between. So we're seeing examples of both. There are examples where universities are really using MOOCs to advertise what they do and almost, you know, claim cultural or academic dominance. But other times when MOOCs are genuinely being used to help solve problems. And the one of the problems with MOOCs, which I'll come back to later, is that students really need to be able to learn. They need to be able to self-regulate their learning. And that's a problem. So if you just simply make resources available, you cannot assume that every single person will then have the self-regulation ability to use those resources. But some of the most promising areas of MOOCs that we've seen have been where they've been focused on a specific area. So I have a PhD student in Denmark, Annette Dalsgaard, now. Annette's studying her PhD, but she's a very experienced academic in midwifery. And she has run an online midwifery MOOC and has had colleagues from literally around the globe who've been studying in this MOOC. Yeah. And what they've done is they've been sharing their practice and understanding why midwifery has to be different in different geographic and cultural contexts, where the climate might be different or the resources available be dramatically different. And so that's an example of a MOOC that can really support and change practice and enable professionals to question what they do in their own practice as well. And ourselves, we're about to run a BOC. We have a project at the moment funded by the Fleming Fund, which is the UK Department of Health and Social Care. And it's trying to solve a global challenge, or at least help tackle the global challenge of antimicrobial resistance. So the idea is that because of overuse or misuse of antibiotics, the bugs that we all have are becoming resistant to these antibiotics. And there's a prediction in about 20 years that antibiotics won't work anymore. And that means a significant change to modern medicine as we know it, because a lot of transplants and cancer treatments rely on antibiotics. This year alone, there's 700,000 people around the world have died because of antimicrobial resistance. So we've been working with the Department of Health, with Mott MacDonald, who are a global company that provide infrastructure for development projects, with colleagues in Bhutan, Ghana and Tanzania. We've gone out to see how laboratory specialists, how they analyse for antimicrobial resistance, and how clinicians and nurses prescribe or use antibiotics. And we've also worked with people in animal laboratory settings and agriculture settings, because antibiotics are used there as well. And we've tried to map out the different knowledge gaps that there are, the roles that people have when the people who need this knowledge. And then we've been thinking about how can we then integrate learning into work so that people are not taking time out of work learning something and maybe not applying it to work, but how they learn as they work. And then what technologies can help us do that. So that the technology, the thoughts of the technology are not at the forefront, but they're as an enabler. So one of the things that we will do is offer a badged open course. It's not a massive open online course, but a badged open course on basic antimicrobial resistance and microbiology, which will be available to colleagues across the piece, across many different countries and in different roles. So that kind of learning is appropriate for basic microbiology for many people. However, we also know that the leaders in the countries need to really rethink how the whole system is structured. So we will offer them something like an evidence cafe online, where they can bring the evidence that they have about how their system is working and then rethink the structure of the system. So, for example, we know that procurement practice encourages people to buy the least expensive medium to grow the bugs. We know that in order to identify which bugs are resistant and which are not, the medium is not accurate enough. They have to change the procurement process. There's no point in people learning how to carry out new forms of AMR surveillance in the laboratory. So all the BOCs and MOOCs that we send will not have impact unless they really think the whole system and change the system.
That's fantastic. So it's more than just the knowledge, it's the context in which that knowledge is applied that you're also hitting as part of this project.
Yeah, correct.
Coming back to MOOCs, there's a school of thought that might see them as more vocationally oriented. I mean, Fred talks a lot about the difference between banking education and emancipatory education. Do you think MOOCs are more towards a vocational and this is what you need to know end? Or have you come across examples of MOOCs which also really do pull learners into new senses of themselves?
I think there are many different types of MOOCs, so it's very difficult to nail down what a MOOC is. And as I said earlier, a MOOC has almost become synonymous with any kind of online learning. I do think that there are examples of MOOCs that really transform the way that people think and their lives. The example I gave earlier about the midwifery education, I think was more than just vocational education around midwifery. Of course, there was some content written by the authors that the midwives could read. But the real transformative experience for those midwives was to meet online and to have either synchronous or asynchronous discussions. And some of them were accessing the MOOC using mobile phones or using apps, and they had very limited access to laptops or computers. And yet they were able to exchange ideas about practice, which helped them to really realise things about their own work. Of course, they were applying what they were learning in the MOOC to their everyday work. So in that sense, the MOOC became part of their work and a really transformative experience.
So they're able to see themselves in the material, and they formed a relationship with the material, the other learners, as a part of that MOOC as well.
Correct, yeah.
Alison, I'm going to put you in a hypothetical situation. Say you had as much money as you wanted and could do the research that you wanted to do. What project would you initiate?
I think that any technology-enhanced learning project should be integrated within a global challenge. So if you take any major global challenge, and we have so many, I described the antimicrobial resistance challenge. So the application of technology to help build capacity and solve that challenge, I think, it is a great one. Diana Lorillard is working on another global challenge, which is about scaling up education. And what she's been doing is to really look at learning design and the way that different technologies can be applied to teacher education so that teachers can be as well informed as we know, as knowledge is, to enable the scaling up of education. We have another project that's just starting up, which is around sexual health and education. And that's a very interesting project because it works across different contexts and different cultures where practices are diverse. And there's an urgent need to really make sure that people are properly educated and protected against various different illnesses that can be communicated and to think about populations as well. Climate change, there are a whole range of different issues. And to me, technology-enhanced learning should be at the core of every single global challenge that we need to meet as human beings. Because in order to solve these challenges, we need to build new knowledge. In order to build that new knowledge, we need to continually learn. Learning and capacity building has to be at the core. So you can choose any global challenge. And I think if I had funding, that's where I would put my funding. And I think that how we think about technology-enhanced learning would go in different directions, because it would be applied to problem that we have to solve, rather than necessarily thinking about education the way that we have done for many centuries, which is around teaching and classrooms. I'm not saying that's not important. Of course, we've all been through the experience and it's been transformative in our lives. But I think we need to think about learning in a much broader way. We don't simply go to school or college or university and stop learning and apply that knowledge for the rest of our lives. We're now in an era where we continually need to learn all the time.
So you're almost talking about problem-based application of TEL. Not starting with the TEL, but starting with the problem, starting with the issue, getting to know the concepts, getting to know the context, and then the technology enabling the solution.
Correct.
Brilliant. Alison, you've written a lot of books over the years. You've spoken a lot of conferences. I've been an avid follower of your work. Who are some people who have actually been influencing you over the years, whose work you admire, and perhaps a rising star also in the online learning space?
There are many people who have, you know, by reading their work or listening to them or working with them, have totally influenced my life. So Loretta Jones, who I mentioned earlier, who's now emeritus. She was at University of Illinois and then University of Northern Colorado in chemistry education. And, you know, she gave me the best advice ever, which is start with the student. That was her strapline. Start with the student. So we have to really think about learners and how they learn. I've been very influenced by the work of people who are not necessarily in technology-enhanced learning, but have been either in sociology or education or educational psychology. So Michael Errett, who was at Sussex, again, he's emeritus. He did very seminal work on how people learn on the job. Alison Fuller and Lorna Unwin at the Institute of Education at UCL in London. Their work particularly on apprenticeships and apprentice learning has strongly influenced me. Anne Edwards at Oxford, one of her key concepts was this idea of relational learning. When we learn, these people are working in professional learning, so when we learn for work, what we learn is relative to what other people know at work. And she did some very interesting studies on teachers and teaching assistants and the relationship and the knowledge there. I could go on. Roger Salio. So many different colleagues have strongly influenced my work, and I find it a joy to read their papers.
Mm. Alison, thank you. It's been really a great pleasure to talk with you. Again, you've influenced me a lot over my own career. All the best for your next endeavours, and thank you for being a legend of online learning.
Thank you, Mark.
I did make one mistake during this interview. The book I was intending to mention early in the conversation was in fact Alison's 2003 book, Reusing Online Resources. You can learn more about Alison and link to her work from our website. Her Twitter handle is Alison L. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.